Okay, so I'm here today speaking on behalf of a number of faculty and graduate students from the University of Missouri, and they're listed here. Dave Patterson is the leader on this grant and has coordinated a lot of this work, including data capture and the like. And then Jared Decker and a bunch of students have had some pretty profound impact on what I'm going to tell you about today. Going to tell you some stories because I actually need to get some backdrop put in place here before we get to the final issue, which is talking about detecting and utilizing and testing for early embryonic developmental lethals. And so to get there, I need to talk to you a little bit about a genotyping assay called the GGPF250 that we built at the University of Missouri in collaboration with GeneSeq about 3 years ago now, and how Jared Decker and his group, Troy Rowan, have been working with that assay to do data imputation, genotype imputation. And I'm going to explain what that is as we go through, because I think there are some incredible opportunities for beef cattle breeding using some of the results that Jared and Troy have developed. And then I'm going to talk about applications of this tool that he's used to actually identify early embryonic lethals and how we might be able to test for them in multiple breeds. So this is not just focused on Angus, but in multiple breeds of cattle. All right. So here's that assay, the GGPF250. We built it in collaboration with GeneSeq. It's a very different genotyping assay to all these other assays. So has this got a pointer? Yeah. So all these other assays, these are all the things that are available in the industry. If you want to go to the right place and shop around and try to get 50,000 or 90,000 or 11,000 or 3,000 SNPs genotype, you can use these things. This assay that we built has 175,000 variable loci on it, but why it's different to all of these is that these things assay what we call common variation in the genome. And what do I mean by that? So, I mean, if you get a SNP and you have an allele that's an A or a B, the frequency determines whether or not it's a common variant or a rare variant. So if the A allele is at 20% and the B allele is at 80%, we would call that a common variant. So if the smaller of those two numbers is greater than about 5%, we'd say it's a common variant. So all of these assays are common variant assays, and the GGPF250 is not. It targets rare variants. And more importantly, it's focused on genes. 68% of all the variants that are on this assay are actually located within genes. That's going to kind of become important as we get a little bit further on. So this is what this picture basically shows that. What it shows is on... Damn it. Okay. What it shows on the x-axis is whether or not we're looking at common variants or rare variants on the assays, with the common variants being on the right-hand side, the rare variants being on the left-hand side. And then the y-axis up this way says, on that assay, proportionally, do you have lots of common, lots of rare? And what you'll see is that the yellow one, which is the 50K assay, that was the very first one that Mark Allen talked about this morning that we worked on in 2006 and built that and brought that to the industry, has lots and lots of common variants on it. The HD assay, bovine HD, which was released about 2 to 3 years after that and has about 770,000 markers on it, has a little more rare stuff on it. But the other one, the purple one that goes up through the roof on this side, is the GGPF250. And it has lots and lots and lots of rare variation on it. Well, don't snooze. I'll explain why that's important. Why that's important is that most of the variation that occurs in mammalian genomes, humans, rats, dogs, cows, is rare. And so what that means is that most of the variation that makes us different from each other and have different EPDs, for example, is rare variation. And we're not capturing that using the assays that we're currently using. We're not capturing all of that. We're missing some of that. So it's important to recognize that most of the chips we're using are looking at common variants, but most of the variation in the genome is rare variation. lethal variants fall in that class, rare variation. And they need to be rare because if you had a lethal allele that was present at 50% in the population, then 25% of your calf crop would be gone just through that one locus. So these are all rare, but we don't really know how many lethal variants there are within individual breeds of cattle because they're really invisible, right? You know, you breed a cow and whether or not she calves is dependent upon lots and lots of factors. And one of those factors is whether or not that embryo was developmentally viable, whether or not it had some mutation in the DNA that caused a gene not to work, which meant that that embryo could not develop to give you a long-term calf. And that's what we're going to get to when I talk. Now, there's lots of room for these genes to exist or these mutations to exist within the human or the cow genome. Because of about the 24,000 genes that exist in the genome, we know that about 10% of them, 2,400, are essential for life. So this work's been done in a lot of other species. It's been done by knocking genes out in mice, and it's been done by looking at cell lines and knocking genes out in cell lines in human. And we know that if you knock out these 2,400 genes, the individual is inviable, any one of those 2,400 genes. So there's plenty of opportunity here, right? 10% of the genes. So, you know, just throw some mutations in the genome. Good chance you might hit one of these things. And if it happens to be a mutation that breaks that gene, you've got yourself a lethal. Okay. So now I need to talk a bit about imputation, because what we're going to do is impute these F250 data along with 50K data. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you look at that table over there on the left-hand side, I know you guys normally don't see genotypes. You know, when they come back from breed associations or zoetis, that's invisible to you. You see when they go and get cranked through the machinery and you get EPDs. But they come back looking like this. So on one animal, there's a SNP, number one, on chromosome one, right at the top at 16,947 bases. And this animal had two copies of the A allele. And so on, for 50,000 SNPs throughout the genome. And some of them will be missing at random, and they're missing just because of chemistry failures. About 1% just do that when you run these assays. You miss them. So imputation is a process whereby we do two things. We figure out which of those two alleles present in the genotype are on each of the two chromosomes. That's called phasing. So we figure out the phase relationship or the number of distinct chromosomes that are present within the population. And then we say we have to figure out what those missing genotypes are. And that's used really routinely. I don't know if GeneSeq does this routinely. Before you send data off to the breed associations, I anticipate you do that. So you get complete data sets. But you can actually be more aggressive than that. You can do things like this. You can say, I've got a 50K genotype on EXT up there. And I actually want to see, can I estimate his whole genome sequence, every variant in the genome sequence on that animal? And that is very aggressive, but it can be done. And the problem is that when you try to impute rare variants, and remember, that's the majority of the variants that are in the genome of an animal, you can't do it very accurately. And there are a number of reasons for that, but it's basically because the assays we're using don't have rare variants on them, right? They're all common variants. So trying to put the rare ones in there in this imputation process is a really, really difficult thing to do. But I'm going to show you, I think it's important. So Troy, are you here, Troy? Don't see you. Okay, so Troy Rowan has been working on this problem for about a year, and he's built a very sophisticated imputation pipeline, which is now publicly available. There's the address there. You can go to that website. You can read the paper. You can download the actual pipeline. And along with this pipeline comes a very valuable resource. It comes with 10,000 animals that have been genotyped with the 777,000 HD chip and nearly 30,000 individuals that have been genotyped with this rare variant chip, this F250 chip. And what we now routinely do with all of the data that we have at the University of Missouri is we genotype an animal with a 50K chip, push it into this pipeline, and what comes out the other end of the pipeline is 850,000 rare and common variants that have been imputed with very high accuracy. And this shows you the kind of accuracies that he's able to achieve. And what we're doing here is we've got a bunch of GelbVs, and they've been genotyped with both the HD and the F250, and we impute them up from 50K to 850K using a reference panel, which is another bunch of GelbVs on the right-hand side there, or the multi-breed, what we call the composite reference panel. And the important thing that happens in this process, it turns out that the composite breed panel works really, really well. But the important thing that happens is your imputation accuracies are all over 90% for the rare variation that's in the genome. And most of it is quite a bit higher than 90%. We now, using this tool, have the ability to take 50K data that all the breed associations have, put it through this tool for free, and get 850,000 variants, where a bunch of that is rare variation. Over 100,000 of those variants are rare variation. So is that worthwhile? Is that an important thing to do? This just shows that if you do it within breeds, all the breeds that we have registered cattle that we've put through this pipeline, the only ones that don't work very well are the breeds that we don't have very much F250 data, but you'll see that's like Romagnola and Brahman and Nadama and Gier. Any breeders of those breeds in this audience? Didn't think so. So everything else, it works pretty darn well for. So why might that be important? Well, my students have just reanalyzed two data sets that we see some very phenomenal results, I think, with. First of all is the feed efficiency. Remember the feed efficiency project? We had about 11,000 animals gathered that we had individual animal intake, we had growth, we had all the necessary information to calculate RFI on those animals. We genotyped a lot of them with the F250 assay. That's why we've got 13,500, because we'd also genotyped them with the 50K or the HD. So we actually genotyped the same animal with multiple different assays. And what that meant was, before we get to that, We put them through another pipeline called Crumbler to estimate what the breed of these animals were. For the most part, there was an awful lot of animals in there that came to us that we had no idea what their breeding was. These animals were sourced from industry sale barns, and we fed them and gathered the data. So we actually put them through another tool that estimated what their breed composition was, and we know exactly of these 10,500 animals, 3,190, give or take, Angus genomes are represented within those animals, but divided out, because they're all crossbred animals. So we know what the actual breeding is of each of these animals. But then we do an analysis where we estimate, shouldn't call it heritability, I should call this genomic heritability or chip heritability. This is the amount of variation in these traits that we can explain using this imputed genotype data set. And you may notice that those values are pretty darn substantial for RFI. And this is analysis with 10,500 animals in it. So you can't say that there's a lot of sampling variation problems right here. Sort of the lowest heritability there we have is for average daily gain, 42%. And just to put this into context, if you compare that with the other estimates we obtained when we analyzed these data sets at various points as we went through the project, two papers are up the top there, you'll see that when we used HD data, 700,000 common SNPs, or the SNP 50, the two columns on the right, the chip heritabilities, the amount of variation we could explain with those markers, are in those two columns there. Now, I appreciate this is not an apples-to-apples comparison, because these are smaller subsets of data. But the one thing that ought to be obvious is there ain't a heritability in any of those two columns that's greater than the heritability we observed when we had the imputed data set. We're seeing increases in chip heritability. And increases in chip heritability are because rare variants are important and we're catching them with this new assay. And what that means is more accurate EPDs, better selection response, right? If heritability goes up, you get more accurate EPDs, and you get better selection response. All right, and this just shows a few Manhattan plots that come out of this. Remarkably, we don't detect new QTLs. The old QTLs that were in this data set are still there. Significance level goes up through the roof. It's like P to the minus 25, 10 to the minus 25. But we're not really detecting a lot of new other large effect genes. And this tells you that the majority of the genes that impact variation in these traits are actually small effect and probably rare in the population. All right. This is another example. Now, this one is apples to apples. So I was also involved in the bovine respiratory disease project. And in that project, along with a bunch of other people, we collected 2,000 Holstein calves in California, 800 Holstein calves in New Mexico, and they were paired up, and a veterinarian had diagnosed half of them had had respiratory disease and the other half did not have respiratory disease. And we analyzed those data and published those data, and we reanalyzed those data with the new imputed H50 data set. And what you'll see there is that in blue, these are the chip heritabilities we got when we analyzed the data using the 777,000 SNP chip. And on the right-hand side, the chip heritability when we include rare variation from the 250. This is an apples-to-apples comparison. Exactly the same data set, just varying the number of markers that were included, rare versus common. And what you see is there's a really appreciable increase in chip heritability when you put rare variation in the analysis. I think this is an important opportunity because it has this effect. And I'm sorry, there's a color swap here. The colors are swapped relative to the assays in the last slide. I just realized that. But if you build prediction equations to predict genetic merit of animals for their risk of BRD, the accuracy goes up. So that's what's in blue. The accuracy goes up when you use the F50. You increase the accuracy of your EPDs just by taking your 50K or your 800K data and imputing the rare variation that is missing, didn't get genotype. It's free, right? You can use Jared and Troy's pipeline to be able to do that. It's free. I think this is an important thing for breed associations to jump all over because you're looking at a free opportunity to increase the heritability of the traits that you have genotyped on your animals just by taking the genotypes that you have on your animals, including estimation of rare variation, and then putting that back into the analysis, you get an increase in heritability, and that means increases in accuracy of EPDs. It's an enormous opportunity, and all it requires doesn't require you spend anything other than time and energy and storage to do the analyses. All right, so the next part of this story, now that we're talking about all these things called haplotypes and the like, is to consider how much genomic diversity, how much diversity do we have within our breeds of cattle. This is something that's kind of fascinated me for a long time. And people always worry about, you know, are we inbreeding too much? Are we losing all the diversity that we have in cattle? Well, it turns out that what is diversity? What do I mean by diversity? So let's just take a piece of a chromosome, so the first, say, million bases on chromosome 1, and say, how much diversity do I have in Angus cattle versus Simmental cattle in that part of the genome? And what I mean by diversity is two things. I mean, essentially, how many variable sites do I have? And you'll see there that Angus have 5 rows and Simmental have 7 rows. So there are more variable sites. So that would suggest that there's more diversity within Simmental. But the other thing to consider is how many genetically different chromosomes, haplotypes, exist within Angus and exist within Simmental, because that's what you're selecting for, right? When you select animals that have the most favorable traits, even if you're selecting on an index, is you're selecting for the chunks of chromosomes that have the best combination of alleles on those chromosomes. And you'll make the greatest progress when you have more of those chromosomes to select, more diversity. Okay, but does it matter what frequencies they're at within the population. You know, you've got 5 or you've got 7 or 8 or 9 haplotypes or 100 haplotypes. Well, what about what frequency they're at? So now let's go down and say, well, in Angus, that first haplotype is 90% frequency. That means that 81% of all Angus animals have 2 copies of that haplotype. And it means the other 19% have copies of everything else. So that tells you they're really, even though you've got 5 of these chromosomes segregating in Angus, you really don't have that much diversity. And when you look across at what I've made up over there for the Simmental, you'll see that there's a much greater balance in the haplotype frequencies there. So you'd look at that and say, well, there's probably greater diversity over there in the Simmentals. Well, there's a formula for that, right, Matt? There's always formulas for things like this. This is called the genotypic diversity formula, and it's just the reciprocal of homozygosity. So the expected number of individuals that you would find to be homozygous. And one of the nice things about this statistic is that it goes from 1 to n, where n is the number of haplotypes. So if you have 10 haplotypes and they're all at frequency 10% in the population, this statistic's going to be 10. So it's like calculating the effective number of haplotypes that you have within a population. So if I then apply that formula to the data I saw right there, I would see that the effective number of haplotypes in Angus is 1.23. That's kind of down towards the one end of the scale. And in the other Simmentals over there, it's 6.61, much more diversity. Okay, so why I walked you through that is that in the process of going hunting for haplotypes that have lethal alleles, one of the things I've been looking at is how much diversity do we have within the different breeds of cattle. And so we've got a data set now from Angus that has 6,600 registered individuals, Beefmaster 37, Brangus over 9,000, Santa Gertrudis a little under 2,000, Simmental 17,000 animals. And we took the 50K data sets on all of those animals, and we imputed them up to 850K. And then we've done an analysis, and you'll see that, oh, nice little squares turned up in there, but you'll see that I've done a number of different analyses where we've used windows that range from just one SNP to 300 SNPs. So, and I want to know if I take the first 300 SNPs on chromosome 1, how many haplotypes do I find within a breed, and what is the genomic diversity within that breed? And then I slide it one position down and slide that thing right through, right along the chromosome. So here's some interesting data. This is the number of haplotypes that we've got. The analyses aren't all run yet. What those check marks showed on that previous slide were the analyses that have finished running. They're just not all done yet, but here's what we've got so far, number of haplotypes. This surprised me. So what breed has the lowest number of haplotypes right down the bottom there? That would be Angus. Okay, does that surprise anybody that they're lowest among all of those breeds? What's next? What's next is Santa Gertrudis. What follows next is two that are right together. That's Beefmaster and Brangus looking together. And then up the top, this one surprised me, that's Simmental. So when you just count the number of haplotypes that you find in a window of the genome, Simmental have more haplotypes than any of these other breeds. That really surprised me. The American breeds didn't surprise me. They're crosses between Brahman and British breeds, and we know Brahman are crazy different. But what if you weight them according to frequencies? Well, things change fairly substantially. Angus is still on the bottom. But then you've got Brangus. Brangus drop right down in terms of their diversity. Simmental come in next, which means that Simmental just has a lot of rare haplotypes floating around. Because Simmental breeders are making crosses between all kinds of stuff, grading those animals up, and there's just a lot of rare variation floating around within the Simmental breed. And then the last two there are the other two American breeds that have greater amounts of diversity. It's kind of important because when you're selecting animals, that's what you're selecting against the diversity that's present within those individual breeds. So, but Brangus really surprised me because I thought, well, Brangus should look like the others, right? The Santa Gertrudis and the Beefmaster up there. I mean, Brangus 62.5% Angus, 37.5% Brahman, right? So they should have lots of Brahman. We should see lots of diversity. So we went and had a look at really what Brangus are. And guess what? Brangus are not 62.5% Angus. Turns out Brangus are 75% Angus and 25% Brahman. That's what selection within that breed's done. Selection has actually gotten rid an awful lot of the actual Brahman that's in their genome. And if you look at a couple of places, you see the top of chromosome 1, that first panel up there? All Brangus animals are 100% Angus there. Does that make sense? Where's Alison? I saw her there earlier. Does that make sense? Yeah, because guess what? Brangus are polled, right? And that's the Angus polled allele being selected into Brangus. There's another one there that makes a lot of sense. Chromosome 18. Just about everything on chromosome 18 is in the middle of chromosome 18 is Angus. Well, that's where the black allele is that puts the black hide color on them. So that makes sense. That makes sense too. But what really surprised me is that there's only a couple of chromosomes, like 13 and 5, I think, where you get anywhere near the breed pedigree expectation for what's present within their genome. And really what's going on here is strong selection for traits where Angus alleles are better than Brahman alleles. And so we know on chromosome 5 that there are a lot of things associated with things like sheath score and environmental adaptation. So that one kind of makes good sense. All right. Did I freeze up? Yeah, okay. All right. So this just shows what the patterns of diversity are throughout the genome. All five breeds there. And I just wanted to show you this because they're all on the same scale. So it reflects Angus right at the top, then Beefmaster, then Brangus, then Santa Gertrudis, and then Simmental. And then that's the average of all of those breeds. And the thing that's interesting about that is that there are patterns that are conserved across all of these breeds. So in the middle of that chromosome, we see a lot of diversity. And the reason for that is that that's where the major histocompatibility complex is. They're the genes that involved in the immune function on these animals, regulating immunity. Let's see. Okay. So now let's talk about lethals. So in the process of analyzing all these data and kind of getting this cool stuff, obviously it doesn't like this slide very much. The other thing we do is test these haplotypes and say, is there any evidence that they might contain a lethal? And is there any evidence out there at all that lethals exist in cattle? Well, I wrote a paper a couple of years ago where I analyzed the literature and went and pulled up all of the lethal alleles that have been identified in all of the breeds to that point in time. The majority of them are dairy cattle breeds, and there are a lot of them, but the message here is that they're pretty much different for every single breed. These lethal haplotypes are different for each breed. So there are different mutations that cause lethal embryonic lethality in different breeds. And they've all been found using this kind of approach. The approach says, I've got two haplotypes, a big A and a little a haplotype, and if I have a big enough sample of data, I want to look to see if I see animals that have two copies of that rare haplotype, the little a haplotype. And if I never see them, I need to be worried that the reason I never see two animals that have two copies of that haplotype is because there's a lethal allele in there, and those animals are not viable. They don't live. So Jesse Hoff, one of my students, worked on this a couple of years ago, and we wanted to figure out, well, how big a haplotype do you need to do these kinds of analyses? All the previous analyses had been done with 50K data. The analysis he did was with 50K data. And he said, well, I think you need about 20. He did some simulations, said, I think you need about 20 markers, and that means you're looking at a region that's about a million bases in the data. And I said, well, that kind of may make sense statistically, but biologically I know that the big haplotypes will have lethal alleles on them that occurred fairly recently. A mutation in a fairly recent bull used in AI. And that the mutations that are older in the population will be on smaller haplotypes. And that's why we did an analysis using different haplotype windows. So going all the way from 1 through to 800. We did 8 separate analyses. I don't have them finished yet for all of those breeds. But what we do is we step through the genome. We say, are there any haplotypes that never turn up in homozygous form? I calculate a p-value that says, should they? And if that p-value is small enough, I collect them. Dump them out and collect them. And that table down the bottom shows how many of those you find when you walk through the genome. In this case, it's Angus. And there's a large number of them. But they represent, a lot of them overlap each other. And so when you put the overlaps together, you get down to those numbers on the right-hand side. 457 is the largest number and 180 regions of the genome that look like they might have lethals in them. But I want to use all of these data simultaneously. So you put the data together for all of these analyses and simply then ask the question, how many of these regions get identified by 2, 3 or more different analyses? And when you do that, the answer is 122 in my analysis. Steve Miller around? Steve was here earlier. Anyway, I know Steve has done this analysis in Angus using 50K data, and I know that they get a number that's actually quite similar to that. These regions are big. They're 1.5 megabases each on average. They get detected by, on average, 5 of these analyses. There are 1,350 genes in these regions of the genome, and 184 of those genes turn out to be essential for life. If you knock them out, you're dead. And if they're all real, they would explain embryonic losses of 8.8%. What that means is that of all embryos that get fertilized, sperm and egg result in a successful fertilization, 8.8% of them would be lost because they're homozygous for one or more of these lethal haplotypes. But only 111 of them actually contain genes. 11 of these regions, I don't know, there's no genes. There's no annotated genes in there. Doesn't mean they're not necessarily lethals, but I don't have any supporting biological information to suggest that they're lethals. But 76 of them do. 76 of these regions have genes in them that are known to be essential for life. And so I think that you can be pretty confident that, those are real. And they explain about 5.5% embryonic mortality rates. So that's where we're at. 2 of these regions have single markers in them that we can use as diagnostics, but we could use all of these as diagnostics right now if the breed associations would impute their 50K data up to 850K data. They could use these results to identify the lethal haplotypes and identify the animals in the populations that harbor those lethal haplotypes, and you could compute EPDs. You can compute EPDs by just taking the frequencies of these across all of them that exist within your population. So what I've shown you today is that this GGPF250 data, which was generated by a large number of projects at the University of Missouri, including Jared Decker's local adaptation project, I think is really important because it allows us to impute our common variant data up to a set that has rare variants in it. And I've shown you 2 different analyses involving 5 different traits where the heritability increases, the chip heritability increases for all of those analyses. I think that is something important for the breed associations to follow up on. I think it's possible for them to use the tool that Jared's group has developed to actually increase accuracies of genomically enhanced EPDs. I think we've got pretty reasonable evidence that there are 76 regions in the Angus genome that harbor embryonic lethals. And if you were to do this imputation, you could develop tests for those and EPDs for those instantly. So there's no hindrance to actually translating these results other than whether or not you truly believe that these are all lethals. We haven't proven that each one of these regions are in fact lethal. The analyses are all underway for Simmental, Beefmaster, Brangus, and Santa Gertrudis, and I anticipate they'll all be done within about the next month. And when they're done, I'll write them up, and I plan to share those and all this information with all the breed associations. And if they're interested in following up and validating these or developing EPDs for embryonic lethality, be happy to, the team on the grant would be happy to work with them to get that done. All right, so acknowledgements. Thanks to everybody that helped us collect animals, shared breed association genotype data with us, the USDA for funding a lot of our work over the last 5 or 6 years, and GeneSeq for working with us to actually build this assay, which I think is going to have increasing impact in the industry. So thanks for your attention. I know it's time to go for a beer.